What's up, guys? Christian here, welcoming you to episode 1 of our new series, Fabiano's Masterclass. I do believe that this one is going to be one of the most comprehensive analytical work that you will find on Chess YouTube, and your teacher is going to be none other than one of the greatest chess players to ever play the game, Fabiano Caruana. Still an active player, still one of the best players on the planet, and I might add, one of the best teachers on the planet as well. The way he explains concepts, the way he goes deep into psychological plays between players, and the way he analyzes overall the games that we will present in this new series, I think is going to make it very obvious that he is not only one of the best players, but also one of the best teachers. So, without further ado, I'm welcoming you to episode 1 of Fabiano's Masterclass. All right, Fabi, first week of Fabiano's Masterclass, our new series. Are you excited?
Yeah, looking forward to looking at some of the recent interesting games with you.
Absolutely, and I think we have quite a selection that we can pick from this week, obviously, because the Grand Swiss is happening. We predicted that that event is going to be extremely fun to follow. And it always amazes me that you're on top of everything and you follow every single game, you try to follow every single trend. But what are we going to look at today?
Yeah, of course, the Grand Swiss has an enormous amount of games each day that have plenty of content, all of them. There are too many to choose from. You know, you could probably look at them all and find something in each which, or in the vast majority, which has some, you know, some interesting nuggets. But let's look at Gukesh, the world champion, and he's playing in the Grand Swiss, although he does not need to qualify for the candidates, obviously. So he's playing just as he would any other event. And he started well, but now he's struggling a bit. He just lost two games to two young, well, one very young and one relatively young, both strong grandmasters, of course. So the first game we can look at is against Abhimanyu Mishra.
And I think this one created quite a buzz. Not only that, you know, Abhimanyu is young, but he's very young. He's 16 in history. I think there's very few parallels where a 16-year-old defeats a world champion, a reigning world champion. I think Prague did it in 2022, but that was rapid against Magnus in Erthings. Kamsky won against Garry Kasparov in 92 in Dortmund. Radjabov, when he was 15, I think defeated Garry Kasparov as well in 2003. There's not as many throughout history, this type of instances. So it's quite a special moment for young Abhimanyu.
Yeah, I mean, of course, it was a huge win for him. To me, it's almost a bit strange that he's only 16, because 2 years ago I played the U.S. Championship, and he was there. He was also there a year ago, but 2 years ago he had a very good U.S. Championship, and he was about 26, 20 or so. So then to think that at that time he was 14 is kind of bizarre. He was so good. He had maybe a bit of a plateau, but these things also happen. Progress is not always linear.
You know, one of the most common questions I get is, how do you actually learn a new opening? Honestly, the best way, hands down, is by using chessreps.com. They've got these super fun, interactive opening courses that actually work. This isn't one of those chess courses you watch once and forget. These are fully interactive courses. You're not passively listening. You're actively playing the moves, getting quizzed on variations, and building that crucial muscle memory. It feels more like a game than studying. Hundreds of thousands of players have already used chessreps.com to break through plateaus and hit their highest ever ELO. And here's the cool part. They actually want you to see how powerful this is for yourself. Right now, you can take their entire Vienna Gambit and Stafford Gambit courses completely free. You don't even have to sign up. Just head over to chessreps.com and start learning. Right now, They have 25 courses for you, and they release a new one every single week. Seriously, this is the best way to learn openings. Go try it out at chessreps.com.
Anyway, let's jump to the game. Abhimanyu Mishra was white. Gukesh was playing black. So e4, e5, and we got an Italian after knight f3, knight c6, bishop c4, which I played recently against Gukesh. It's a huge battleground these days. Bishop c5, d3. Usually this move order indicates that white wants to play bishop g5 lines and stays a bit flexible with castling. So that's what we got with knight f6, bishop g5, h6, bishop h4. Again, a huge battleground, one of the most theoretical openings these days. Like, when I prepared for the World Cup 2 years ago, this was my main focus. And I think you could spend a week or two and only begin to scratch the surface of these lines because there are so many possibilities and they're so complex and engines struggle to give you helpful advice in these positions as well.
What would you say are the most impactful, let's say, details of this position? Obviously, we know the general ways in which you can play, leaving the bishop on c1. But whenever you go bishop to g5, you're obviously throwing the gauntlet at your opponent. What are some of the details that we should be aware of?
I mean, the most pertinent is that when white pins this knight, black has to do something about the pin in the long term. There are kind of two ways to do it. One, which is very obvious, which is what happened in the game. And the other one is a little bit maybe for the uninitiated, perhaps a little bit counterintuitive, which is to lose a tempo playing bishop to e7. You could do in this position. But you break the pin. Mm-hmm. For example, I had a game, I think it was directly in this position 2 years ago in Grand Swiss against Yevgeny Nayar. These kinds of positions are fine for black. But it's not the most aggressive way for black to play, and it's not the most fashionable. Usually people prefer not to lose time with this move. Although it is, in some sense, the safest, it's like the least complicated of black's options. The most complicated is what Gukesh did. So he didn't lose time. He played d6. Sorry, actually, first he played a6. But I think the move orders don't matter too much if you play a6 or d6. I mean, one difference is that black can play a5. But anyway, he played a6, castle, and now d6. c3 and bishop to a7. Knight d2. Again, there's a million. You can play a4 first, knight d2, b. I mean, there's a million things. But knight d2, and for example here, Prague against me, we had a game in the World Cup, he castled, played queen e7, and then bishop e6. It's kind of a safe, classical way of approaching his position. But Gukesh did not go for this, he went for g5. So that's the fundamental way to break the pin. Now, the idea that you asked about, what's white's idea of the line? Well, to break the pin, we provoked a weakening of black's kingside. On the other hand, we lost some time, and the bishop is now on g3, a little bit passive, arguably. One of white's main ideas here is to play d4, opening the center, because black's king is a bit weaker. And one of black's main ideas is to attack on the king side. That explains Gukesh's next move, which is very rare, knight to h7. Mm-hmm. What's the idea? Black wants to play h5, not allowing knight takes g5. That would trap the bishop. It's actually something that we see very directly. So this is very rare. Usually people play queen e7 first to fortify e5, b4, and then they play either knight h7 or d7, very often transposing because the knight goes to f8 to g6. I had a game here against Bogdan Daniel Dayak. He played knight to h7, I played bishop d5. It didn't actually work out, the opening, for me. I got a bad position, and eventually it was a draw. It was Grand Swiss. So I've played this stuff quite a few times myself. But Gukesh played somewhat novel approach. He played knight h7 immediately. Now, the downside with this move is the center is no longer firmly defended, so d4 comes. And if black takes, then white will sacrifice a pawn. But white can afford to do that because black's king is in the center. You can, for example, play e5, or you could recapture.
And if you take.
Yeah, probably.
On d4, I mean, yes.
You know, I see from the eval bar shifting that maybe white takes back. It's always a difficult, like black takes, 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 and then knight goes to f3, and, or in this case, there's even queen to a4, and bishop takes f7 tricks, I guess there's some tactics here as well, which, as you can see, I'm not so booked up on this particular variation, but in any case,
it's extremely dangerous to play that pawn, right?
I mean, Gukesh, of course, knew the position. He played knight h7, it was preparation. So after d4, he played h5. Very logical. The point is, he wants to play h4 next move and trap the bishop. And this position has been played a few times. I think one game of Fedor's save continued h4 for white, saving the bishop, very logical. g4, knight to e1, and now black can capture on d4. And black has won a pawn, and white has a typical compensation. For example, knight to d3. And the game continues. You know, white has safer king, a knight on f4 coming, maybe e5, and black has a pawn, which is, in its own right, very important.
Yes.
So Misha thought for a long time, and he decided not to play h4. He decided to take on e5.
I think it's a good moment to point out that Gukesh was indeed extremely well prepared. He hasn't spent any time up to this point, 1 hour and 42 minutes, and Mishra was out of book for quite a while now. Like at this point,
Well, I can tell you, knight to h7 was a surprise for Mishra.
Yes.
Because you can't prepare everything. You know, black can play knight d7, queen e7, black can play bishop g4, black can castle. I mean, they're unlimited. And besides, there are the lines where black plays a5 instead of a6, and all of those have their own nuances and subtleties. And black can, at any moment, play a different move. So black has, like, literally 25 different systems. And you can't be ready for all of them. That was one of my main issues with this opening for white. Gukesh, on the other hand, playing black, only needs to prepare one system. So that's what he did. And that's why Mishra was out of prep and started to think. And he took on e5. Which took Gukesh out of prep. So it's actually interesting to me that it took him out of prep because, well, I mean, it is a capture.
It is the most natural move, right, in a position.
It loses a piece, but it is a capture. I mean, it initiates some tactics. Clearly, he had prepared only h4. Maybe he had checked h3 too. But okay, it's possible to miss moves in analysis. What happens next after d takes e5? I cannot explain. If you gave me a million years to explain Gukesh's next move, I don't think I could do it. Although, of course, chess is complicated and sometimes we go along the wrong logical path and we confuse ourselves. But okay, clearly black's idea was to play h4. It traps the bishop. So maybe he checked something here and didn't like it, but he knows that the position after h5 is fine for black. He knows this because he prepared it, which means that d takes e5 cannot be a refutation, which means that he has to play h4 because it's the only move which doesn't lose on the spot. So anyway, the line goes here, h4, knight takes h4. White sacrifices a piece. White was losing it anyway, but then has queen to h5. Attacking f7, looks a bit scary, and h4. We defended with queen to e7. Bishop takes h4, and queen to f8. Of course, black lost a lot of time. It's a bit scary. On the other hand, we are up a piece. And here white has...
It does look scary.
It does look scary, but, I mean, you know that the position is okay. You kind of have to reach this point in your thought process. Now, you know, white has a dangerous move, knight to f3, for example. And here, queen to g7 is important. It's a final, like, very important move. e6. White is trying to gang up on f7, but king to f8. And black's king is no longer in danger. For example, e takes f7. We have bishop to g4. And there's no checks, there's nothing. So, you know, black is up a piece and also counterattacking. So the position after king to f8 it's between equal and better for black. It's like, objectively, if you let a strong engine run for 10 minutes, it starts to say equal. If you let it run for 30 seconds, it says black is somewhat better. So,
yes.
But okay, this, for me, it's understandable to not figure all these details out. But the alternative, Gukesh's move, is clearly bad and losing for many reasons. I mean, he plays g4, which does not win a piece, because white can play knight to h4, for example. Knight takes d5, and bishop to b3, for example. White is significantly better here, because, well, you know, white has stopped the main idea of h4, so black is left with some somewhat damaged structure and worse position. White can also play bishop to h4 instead of knight to h4, forcing queen to d7, and then knight d4. And, okay, knight d5, I mean, it remains kind of complicated, but white is significantly better here, again. Mm-hmm. Although here he maybe thought knight g6 is coming and felt good about it. So, like, just based on this, I would think G4 should be rejected on principle, and you should just focus all your energy on H4, because, you know, obviously G4 is not the idea. It doesn't win a piece. H4 does. The bigger issue with G4, even bigger than those, is that white actually sacks a piece, and it's completely crushing. E takes D6, Mishra was brave and correct in doing this. G takes F3, otherwise white simply plays knight H4 and just up a pawn for nothing. DC7, attacking the queen, queen E7 and knight F3. And here white has four pawns for the piece, so it's no longer a sacrifice. There's also a pawn on C7.
Mm-hmm.
And furthermore, white...
That's the big problem.
Yeah, that's... Even without the pawn on C7, I guess white would be better, but...
I guess the question is, why can't you just simply take it in a couple of moves?
Okay, bishop d6 is coming. Bishop b6, bishop d6. Mm-hmm. You don't get there in time. I mean, queen d7 is probably what... Yeah, knight e5. I mean, there's probably other moves, because it's just, like, obviously black is tactically in huge... I mean, look at black's pieces. They don't attack anything. They're scattered. Take, and then if the rook goes to g8, then there's queen h5. I assume mm-hmm. this is the case, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and so, if you take, you simply don't have time to move the rook because of rook d8 check.
Yeah.
Which finishes the game.
It is also four pawns, which means that, materially speaking, white is kind of ahead if we use the traditional material balance. So yeah, after knight takes f3, this is a disaster. It's four pawns and a passed c7 pawn and initiative. Here, Gukesh starts to fight well. But how he got to this point is just inexplicable to me, at least. Bishop g4, he provoked h3, which was kind of a clever idea, because basically he figured that at some point he'll play rook g8, and h3 will be more of a weakness than a strength, so he goes back to e6. Now, I think, like, the most crushing was bishop e6. Like, a strong engine showed queen e6, knight h4, like, evaluated as +4, I think. That's from what I checked.
Just knight f5 is coming, and there's not enough ways to stop it.
And if f takes e6, I guess at that point you could play bishop d6, or... Yeah, I guess there are probably various options. Like, also, to me, knight e5 looks very dangerous. Yeah.
It is completely winning.
Because you're maybe winning the fifth pawn, so it's getting to be too many pawns at some point. Yeah. Anyway, Mishra played bishop d6. It's an understandable move. White is a bit spoiled for choice, which can sometimes be an issue. Queen d7. Take. Queen takes. I think it's very logical he thought that the bishop on d6 is a tempo. It turns out it was better on g3, but that's an understandable thing for him to have done. Mm-hmm. Now he played e5, bolstering the bishop. Again, maybe not the best, but not a bad move. King to d7. A nice creative way of basically, if black gets enough time to play rook AG8 and king C8, you could start to see where the king gets safe and black has his own counterattack.
Right. Unfortunately, and again, if you lose the pawn on C7, you know, things become quite interesting after that. Like, black can definitely fight, if not even claim an advantage.
The issue is that you can't attack that pawn immediately. For example, the best move here is B4. Let's say rook A to G8, threatening queen H3 and king to H1. And if bishop to b6, we have bishop to c5. King c7, queen d6.
Oh, that's nice.
And we win the bishop, and now we're up two pawns in the endgame and completely winning, of course, with such a material advantage. And then if black doesn't play bishop to b6, for example, after king h1, let's say king c8, getting the king out of discovered checks. Now a4. Black is one tempo too slow, because b5 is coming and the attack is very strong. Although, I think it's not easy to understand the strength of this idea with b4.
Yes.
It's crushing, but it's not so obvious. Like, it is based on one tempo in a lot of lines, and I understand why Mishra didn't understand the full strength of this idea.
It feels slow, right? It feels slow, of course, once you see it on the board. Obviously, you understand that you are ahead and you will be first. But playing b4 and following that up with king h1, because you have to fend off black's threats, it just doesn't feel right whenever you start calculating this type of situations. You want something more concrete, you want something more direct, I feel.
Yeah, no, I think it's totally understandable. I think this is why bishop d6 was kind of a practical mistake, because it made his task more difficult, although objectively it was a winning move. But yeah, not maybe not the most practical. So his next move was a big mistake. After king to d7, he played knight d4. It's a forcing move. Unfortunately, it takes a lot of the sting out of white's attack, because now he plays bishop d4. cd4, queen d5, excellent move. I think basically Mischa assumed that he's taking h5 and it's another pawn and it's just too much. Mm-hmm. But now black has light squares, and his king is safe because all the light squares are covered. So queen h5 was played, is logical, and now Gukesh continues to defend well with knight f6.
That is a lot of pawns, by the way. It's like 4 pawns right now.
It's a lot of pawns, but unfortunately you're probably losing one of them. I mean, currently it's 5 pawns.
Perhaps he missed knight f6.
I think rook a to g8 is also okay, but it's not the best. Like rook a8, queen f5, queen e6, it's, I mean, okay in a sense, like black is not losing immediately.
Yes.
The issue is that he doesn't get the knight out there. And here after knight f6, queen f5, queen e6, and the trade, I mean, Mischa could have not traded, but I think actually he probably made the right decision by trading, because queen f3, it's, you know, black has the knight. Black has more attacking potential here. Like knight to d5, I wouldn't know that white is better here, because knight takes d4 is coming, rook g8 is coming. I mean, the engine says white is winning, but okay, this is not obvious at all. He could have also played rook ag8 after queen f3, and the knight on f6 is still immune, because
if
the bishop
on d6.
If you would
ask me who I think is better in this position, I would say black maybe 10 out of 10 times.
It's a natural assumption.
If I get to think about it, maybe I can start calculating and realize that white has ideas. But visually, it feels like black is doing quite well.
Yeah, I think it's a very natural assumption. And that's why he traded queens, which is a normal move and a normal decision. I wouldn't criticize this at all. So after f takes, maybe he shouldn't have played f4 here. Maybe he should have taken, and then he tries to count on his massive pawns on the king side, but it does look like he's losing a lot of them. Like f6, it looks like he'll lose that. For example, rook f8, g5, rook g8. I mean, he does lose it. I know, f4, rook f6, c8. Okay, so there are some tactics here which he actually can't take that. Yeah, now there's no pin. But, you know, it looks like you're losing a lot of your pawns, so I understand
it does.
Why he
it
didn't
does.
Do it. On the other hand, there is this kind of thing. My general feeling is that if you have a bad bishop, like the bishop on d6, it can just be so bad sometimes. Like, I'd rather play against one knight with no bishop than two knights with the bishop that does nothing. Anyway, he chose to play f4, which is not a bad move, and again, not something you can criticize, just a responsible decision. Knight to d5, so Gukesh is back in the game. There's no queens on the board, he's not getting mated, he has very good knights. The c7 pawn can be taken at will. The d4 pawn is also hanging. I mean, of course, white has 4 pawns, so it's very dangerous, because in a lot of endgames, the pawns will outpower a piece. Like, if you traded, for example, all the rooks and a bishop for knight, the pawns probably just outpower the knight, because white gets his king to f3, for example, starts pushing on the king side, and 3 pass pawns, you know, it's very often a bad outcome. But we're very far away from trading all the pieces, so
yeah.
He's out of the woods for now. f5. The reason he did this was because after trading on f5, black cannot play knight c7, so he's just trying to keep his pawn alive. Very, very logical. And if we look at the outcome of the game, it looks like a brilliant decision. So knight takes d4, gave a check, king goes to e6. It is immune from checks here, which shows the power of the knight on d5. On the other hand, we have that passed pawn on c7. I think in general, white doesn't risk much here, because black is kind of out of pawns. Like, to win a game, even if you're up a piece, you need a few pawns left. If we start to trade down pieces. And black is only 2 pawns left. You know, if white plays c8, for example, here, we already eliminate another pawn. Of course, we don't want to do that because our pawn is much better. But we can at will eliminate more of black's pawns. So he played rook to f1, defending the rook. What did he play here? Knight to b5, right? Rook g8 first.
Rook g8. Yes.
Yeah, fine move. I mean, you know, all moves here are about equal if we look at it from an objective point of view. Of course, from a practical point of view, very complex position. Now knight to b5.
And at this point, both players, by the way, this is move 30, both players about, okay, Gukesh 10 minutes, Abhimanyu 7 minutes 28. Remind me, what is the time control for this event?
Well, they get more time on move 40 and then on move 60. I think they get an hour more on move 40. So
it's a very long time control.
It's very long. It's the longest there is in chess. You know, we have 8 hour game. We had an 8 hour game, Erdogmus against
190 moves.
Yeah, 190 moves against Noderbeck Abdusatarov. Crazy. I mean, I've had a few games 7+ hours, but these days it's pretty
rare.
8 hours
is a lot.
Yeah.
Yes.
Knight b5. What did he play here? Yeah, rook to h7. Yeah, so preparing rook to h6 check and rook f7 as well. And now I think that the easiest move, the easiest way to make a draw here is rook to h8. Because you trade off a pair of rooks, then you take on d6. And yeah, it's going to be like you're going to lose your last two pawns there. And white will have the two pawns on the king side. Mm-hmm. For example, rook c1, take on d6. Or rook c, it doesn't take rook c8. I mean, I guess
a rook c8.
Yeah, rook c8, yes. King to g2, or king h2. I don't know, king d6, king g3 or something. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, probably it's all a draw now. For example, knight c7. You know, I think most people would try to keep the rooks on because it keeps some winning chances for black, maybe. But white has the two passed pawns, and black has very few pawns left. So it's a very drawish position. You would say 99% between two grandmasters of this strength that they finish the game. But Gukesh made a move which I think we can attribute to him wanting to keep pieces on and maybe try to swindle Mishra in a time scramble. But if you ask me, he was so lost and he's not better that he should take his draw and you know, run home with his prize, because it was not looking like he would draw this game, you know, for the majority of it.
But this is very much Gukesh and his style. He's very confident. He always tries to keep the game going. We've seen it during the World Championship against Ding, sometimes at the expense of making the best moves in the position and taking the best decisions. And, you know, so far, based on his obviously extremely good results, overall it has worked for him. But it is a strategy that sometimes backfires. And in this case, I think this one was one of those cases.
Yeah, whatever you say about Gukesh, he is an incredibly fighting player. He fights, and I think that's admirable, he fights against anyone to the bitter end. But objectivity is a very important thing as well.
Yeah.
Now, I can't say for sure that rook g6 was a winning attempt. Maybe he saw something after rook h8 that scared him. But that would be my best guess. On the other hand, I don't really see how this creates winning chances for black. Like, let me just make a random move here. King to h2. I don't think it's a good move. Like, what's the best outcome? You take on d6, and we get the same type of position, basically. I'll play, let's say, king g3 here. I mean, okay, here
no,
you lost
sorry.
A piece, yeah.
That one doesn't work.
But I mean, like, your best case is gonna be that you play rook c8 instead of knight c7, and then you take on c7 with the rook, if you get a chance, and then we get the exact same position. I mean, there is having two rooks on the board only makes it worse for black, because your king is in danger. White's king is surrounded by pawns, it's safe. Black's king is vulnerable to checks. You can potentially, like, I play rook d1 here, I threaten rook h5. You have to move your king. Where do you go? e6? I can give you a check. I mean, you're going back to d6 anyway. You're not trying to win this position. If I'm totally unambitious with white, I can do this. But Mishra was not unambitious. So after rook g6, he played a very ambitious move. Basically, it was also the idea behind his last move, to play rook f7. Which was a mistake, but again, it's a difficult position. I mean, rook d1 was correct. And winning.
What's the idea behind this?
I think it's just freezing black from ever taking
so
on d6.
Something like rook c8.
Yeah.
What's
king f2? I guess
and
you
I
just
can never take on c7. Is that the case?
Well, if you
so
take
if I take on c7 like this.
take. You have to take with the... Well, if here, rook, this, then... rook d6 wins a rook. You have to take with the rook, yes. And then I have take, take, rook d6, king f7, rook d7. So...
Yes, so you're basically now, frozen, more or less.
Yeah, so basically, it's maybe a bit difficult to understand this, but possible. But again, they're very low on time. I mean, his idea behind rook h7 was to play rook f7. Yeah. So he followed up with his idea. It was a mistake, but one that you can kind of understand because the position... There's knights jumping around, it's confusing, you know. Still, it shows that rook g6 was a pretty serious mistake. So rook f7... He wants to also play rook d7, rook d8. So I think here he played rook c8, which looks like the most logical move. And then I guess he played rook d7 here.
Yes.
Which is... I mean, you're preparing rook to d8. I don't know if it's... I guess it's a pretty serious threat, right?
It does look quite serious. I mean, you I do think have he... rook g8, but...
Yeah, but then rook h6 comes and your king gets into serious trouble. Yeah, so basically, mm-hmm. here Gukesh played rook h6, which to me looks like a fine move. I mean, the fact that it's dangerous is a result of, well, his rook g6 move along with the rest of his play in this game, which was pretty careless overall. Rook to h6 is a defensive measure. It's not a winning attempt anymore. I think he realized how much danger he's in. Rook d8 is coming and... You know, he didn't want to play rook g8, first of all, because you just came from there. Like, his yeah. alternative was to play rook 6g8 and then to play rook h8 next. Or not even to play rook h8, but to play, I guess, knight takes d6, and then it looks very scary. I mean...
Rook takes d6, king takes d5, like, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah, this is...
Rook d7, and wild. Then it's scary. Rook d7 and king e6. Okay, I mean...
It you feels don't like this... you have to worry about getting checkmated and losing the knight at the same time. Like, for example, if you go knight to b6, already you start getting into some dangerous territory.
Yeah, for like example, rook this... d8 and rook h6 is a threat and probably only move his knight to a8. I mean, it's...
Ridiculous.
It's, again, you basically took all this risk for nothing because white can just give checks at will and can never lose his position if they don't yes. go crazy. So he played rook h6. I think it's a good move. The fact that it's dangerous after rook d7, knight e7, rook h6, king d7, and this is a dangerous position, is, first of all, it's probably still a draw, and it's also difficult to understand which one to go for white. So, Mishra basically tempted Gukesh. After rook h6, he played rook hg7, which is like waving, you know, red in front of the bull, because... Gukesh has had no winning chances the entire game. He's been losing for most of it. But now, he can take the pawn in h3. And theoretically, if he gets rid of the c7 pawn, he actually does have decent theoretical winning chances because now white doesn't have the passers on the king side that were, you know, basically the bailout, right, for white was always that we have these two passers, so worst comes to worst, we lose all our other pawns, we still have these two guys. Now we don't. On the other hand, black has completely distracted himself from the c7 pawn, and that's why he played a4 now. So he can't take, so the knight is going to have to abandon that pawn. He could have played knight takes d6. And this is a draw in a million ways. For example, rook d6, king e5, rook d8. Rook c7 leads to a draw, take, 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 everything, and rook b3, for example, rook g3, whatever. Everything's a draw. Mm-hmm. Or after knight d6, I guess e d6 is the more scary move.
Yes.
Yeah, I guess you have to see... I don't know if you have to. Maybe can you try rook h8? I'm just curious if rook h8 is a bad move. Yeah, also a fine move,
still
probably.
Still works.
Still probably a draw. Like. So,
but
okay.
It is scary. Like,
it's a bit
being
scary.
Being so passive looks scary.
Although rook g3, rook g4 is not difficult. I mean, it's just, he already used this deflection of the rook, right? So... Yeah, here you don't want, because actually... No, you have to play rook d8 now, and rook g7, rook c8, white is barely making it, king d6, rook d8, but white does make the draw.
Yeah.
And, you know, probably Mishra calculated some of this stuff, had given up on his winning attempts. Probably Gukesh also had given up on his winning attempts. Or sorry, I should say, probably Gukesh had not given up on his winning attempts. That's why he played knight d4. Because I think knight takes... You could also play knight c7, by the way. Knight bc7, bishop c7, rook c7, rook c7, knight c7, rook c7, rook g3. I think rook g3 is fine. King f2, rook g... I mean, it's a very trivial draw, right? This is like, trade all the pieces, take, as Hikaru would say. And there's no pieces left. So the draw was there for the taking. But knight to d4 came, an ambitious move. Also, not really in a winning attempt. But, you know, we've already... You know, he was clearly pushing too hard at this point. So bishop c5 comes, which attacks the knight. But also, if you move the knight, let's say, to c6, then I think there's like rook d6, rook g5 stuff, which... Maybe you still survive. I don't know, because you have eliminated so many of Black's pawns, but so many of White's pawns, that is. But yeah, you're down a pawn.
The
and
king looks very unsafe, though.
Yeah, it's a bit borderline. So after bishop c5, I think he had to find an accurate move. It was rook to d3, right?
Yes.
And I think now if rook d6, king e5, rook g5. Here he has the knight f3 and he maintains contact with the knight.
You're even winning.
And wins, yes. So after rook d3, you play rook d8. And Black has nothing better than a repetition. Now, I don't know what Gukesh calculated or missed, because they were getting down to seconds. Yeah, you can't go to e1 because knight f3. Oh, I mean, you can, but...
You can, but the knight defends the rook and...
So yes, with seconds, this is you can blunder mate here. I mean, it's a position where the king has only one square in all cases, like rook d6, king e5. I mean, you're playing a position where your king is in a mating net with 30 seconds on the clock. I think we understand the danger. So after bishop c5, Gukesh got very low on time. As we see, he had 41 seconds at the start. He probably got down to like 5 seconds or so. And he played knight to e2.
Which
is a losing move, 6 seconds. It's a losing move. He had to find rook d3. And the problem for White is that there are three legal moves. One loses, and the other two win. And the one which loses is very obviously dumb, because king g2 allows a check. Like, if you play king g2 here, you allow a check. It loses for White. The other knight, I think. And... I mean, it doesn't... Why would you allow this check? The knight is hanging on e2. So, of course, you attack it first with king f1. Exactly what Mishra did. So, the issue with knight e2 is that it forces White to win. And also gets him closer to time control. And now, if knight e to f4, then... Which is what he did. Then bishop to d4. I guess he missed this move. It's possible to miss because it's a backwards retreating move. But it does threaten maiden 1. And I was watching live and... Of course, the look on Gukesh's face was that of, like...
Shock.
Not even shock, because I think he had seen it. It was more like, once the move actually came on the board, it was more like deflated. Like, I think he immediately understood that he's losing, because mate in 1 is threatened, and if the knight on d5 moves to e3, we simply take, and then rook e7 is mate.
Oof.
So, the king is in a mating net. It's a weird mating net. Pawn on g4, pawn on e5, but... A mating net nonetheless, and that means after bishop d4 that you have very few options. You have to give checks.
Is that
That pawn, you go towards the center. No, the pawn on g4 is actually so important that king g1, rook g2, and rook g4 screws it up completely. So, because rook d6, king f5, Black's king escapes.
So many tactics.
So yeah, it was clear that after bishop d4, which Mishra spotted, I think, immediately, basically. I was watching live, and he saw it very quickly, that Black needs to find checks, but where are the checks? So he plays rook f3, king to e1. Another issue is that, White keeps getting closer to time control with only moves. Knight d3, because knight g2, king e2, so knight d3, king to d2 to avoid any checks. No, there are no more. I mean, there's one legal check, but it drops all your pieces, so... he took on e5, but this loses a piece. Bishop takes e5, king e5, rook g5. Yeah, I take. And Unfortunately, rook c7, it's very close to making a draw, but we're going to take. And yeah, we take again. Yeah, I guess, I mean, it requires some calculation. Like, there's rook f4, but I guess you, like, rook f4, b3, rook g4, and rook b6. Okay. It's kind of standard calculation, especially since white no longer risks. So it's, you know, it's a sense of relief. You pass the time control, you are up two pawns. Maybe you're not 100% sure how winning, but it slowly dawns on you that not only is it much better, it's also safely winning.
Yeah.
And the rest of the game was pretty accurate for Mishra. Rook gd5, rook b3, check, just to gain some time, I guess, or, you know, professional approach, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And now he played rook d3, which is not the only good move, but it's very concrete. He took the pawn, king c1. He's trying to get the rook to c3, which he did. Rook h2. First g5. I wonder, is rook c3 was immediately also fine, or...
Yeah, yes, probably. But not as much.
Yeah, it seems. Yeah, okay, g5. But basically his
getting
idea
the pawn
is
to g7 is important.
Yeah. His idea is very often that he'll play rook c3 and rook d8 at some point. So after g5, what do you do? Was it king to f5? Yeah, check. King e6. I guess if he goes to g6, then rook c5 now. Rook h8, yes. And probably a move like a5 to really... or maybe just bring the king up. Yeah. Black is paralyzed. The pawn is c7. It actually survived the whole game, kind of ironically. King to e6 he played. So did he push a... Yeah, first check, and then rook d2. Yeah, that's very accurate. So if he trades, then king d2, king to e6, and rook to g7 or h7, I guess doesn't matter too much. If king d6... Well, but you could also play g6. So even if all the pawns are traded on the queen side, yeah, I mean, you know, your pawn promotes. After rook d2, he kept the rooks on the board, logical. King moved, king f5, rook g7. Now he probably wants to kick the king away from f5 again, rook f2, and then start pushing the g-pawn again. So, played rook h8, rook f2. Again, I think black is so paralyzed that he's spoiled for choice. King to e5, g6, second pawn is running, rook h4, rook gf7. It doesn't matter if you take on a4 because I played g7. And then next move, rook f8, pre-move. Rook a4, g7, rook g4, rook f8, and two rooks against one rook. So two rooks are better than one rook. I actually had this exact endgame once against Lenier Dominguez from 2012. Not this exact position. Black's king was on the king side somewhere, and it was like two pawns and rook against two rooks. But the king was around the pawn, so it took a while to actually win that pawn. Took me like 10 moves or so. Okay, so anyway, he plays b5. Yeah, trade, g7. Two pawns, rook f8 is unstoppable. He gave a few checks, king b3. Rook f8 is coming next move. And that's why he resigned. And that was the win by Abhimanyu Mishra against Gukesh.
And I think, you know, such an impressive win, first of all. Congratulations to Abhimanyu. Obviously a very difficult loss for the world champion, but something that he's shown strength to recover from. But also during the masterclass, we're not going to be analyzing only the chess part of it, but also the psychological part of it. And I do want to ask you, because you've been in this position before as you were surging through the rankings, as well as you were getting closer to 2700, you know, you were feeling that elite level already. Do you feel like Abhimanyu knows or feels like he's getting closer? And how much does a victory against a world champion, a victory against a 2760 rated player at a time when you're 2611, how much does that do for your confidence? And do you remember an instance in your career when you felt, hey, this is, I can do this. I can actually reach the pinnacle of chess.
Well, I think naturally it's very important to get those successes when you're young, and it gives you confidence, which is one of the major driving factors for young players. Nobody ever got good without confidence, mm-hmm. and without ambition. when I mean good, I don't mean like of course there are many great players, but I mean like, you know, potentially top 10 in the world. Nobody ever got there without confidence and self-belief. And yeah, it's one of those games. I mean, I can think back to a time, a similar age for me and a similar level of player, of opponent. I played the World Cup in 2009. So I was 17 at the time, but I just turned 17. It was in Hanti Mansisk. First round, I played Lazaro Bruzon, which was about a 50-50 matchup. We were both around 26-50. So again, a similar rating I was to Mishra as well, you know, so somewhere around those 26, mid-2600 levels. And I beat Lazaro Bruzon in the first round, and then I played legitimately top player at the time, Lenier Dominguez, who was probably around 27-20, and of course he was quite young. He was, you know, one of those young talents, born, I believe, in 1983 or 82. So he was in his mid-20s, and very tough back-and-forth match. You know, it went two classical games, two draws, then rapid games, draws, and eventually I actually won the match. It was a big surprise for everyone. Then I played Yevgeny Alexeyev, a name which probably a lot of our viewers aren't too familiar with, but he was a 27-20 player at the time. Even became, I think, at his peak around 27-40, although I might be off a bit, but yes. Yeah.
No, I think you're right.
Around that. And again, back and forth match, I remember like many Russian players, and this was in Russia as well. We were playing Russia. He was a Russian star, you know, young guy, 27, 20, 30 level, playing this kid. I remember a lot of people watching it. Went to Blitz, and in a Blitz playoff, I knocked Alexeyev out. Now, the top two seeds in the tournament, one was Boris Gelfand, 27-57. I remember exact ratings of the guys. And the other player was Vugar Gashimov, who very sadly passed away at a young age, but he was a great player, you know, one of the best of his generation. He became a top player for many years until his illness.
Best Benoni player ever.
Yeah, he was a Benoni champion of the Benoni, and you know, it's just very sad we didn't get to see more of his chess. But he was a top player. They were tied, both 27-57, the two guys. So they were the favorites of the tournament. There were also other guys like Karjakin, Ponomaryov. These guys were favorites. In the fourth match of the tournament, I played Vugar Gashimov. So I'm playing a guy very similar in rating to Gukesh, of course. He wasn't the world champion, so it's a bit different in that sense. But 27-57, 27-67, we're talking
to say... Rating-wise is very close.
Yeah, he was like number five in the world, you know, more or less, Gashimov. And first game I saved a very dubious position. He was very well prepared. He surprised me in open Spanish. Second game we played a lot of Neidorf. I had a huge advantage. Huge advantage winning at some point, and he survived in a long fight. Then we went to rapid. It was four rapid games after two classical. And he beat me in the rapid playoff. And I remember just like after I drew the second game, I felt so dejected. Like I had just missed the chance to beat, you know, one of the absolute top, even after beating two, you know, top 30 guys, to beat another, like one of the best, absolute best in the world. And to get to the final four, I think it would have been of the World Cup. But still, like
17, that's huge.
That tournament, like it gave me so much confidence to play. Yeah. Lenier and Alexeyev on equal terms, and to play Gashimov nearly on equal terms, you know, it gave me enormous confidence. It's a bit different. I mean, he won the game against Gukesh. It's of course a bigger accomplishment, but still, it reminds me a bit of that. Like these early tournaments that give you some confidence are really, really important. And we see also some other kids who are doing well, Erdogmus, Maurizi. You know, Maurizi is maybe a bit older, but they're young guys. They're performing well.
The big story is Erdogmus and Gurel as well. He's a very promising player from Turkey. It does seem like the Turkish system is finally starting to pay off, and the investments that they've done in the infrastructure, in the coaching, in, you know, bringing a lot of grandmaster coaches. Turkey used to be not a chess country. Like you would be thinking about Turkey and the top player was, I don't know, Emre Can, around 25-50. Nowadays...
Well, I mean, there's Mustafa, who was about 26-50. Mustafa Yilmaz.
Yes, came a little bit after, yes.
And, like, if we're talking... if we're talking players who aren't Turkish originally, but some players moved to Turkey, I mean, Suat Adalik, I think originally he's Bosnian, but he played for Turkey. He was also, like, a... maybe at his peak top 50 player. And also, okay, I'm kind
Dragan
of blank.
Dragan Šolak, perhaps?
Well, I'm blanking at the moment, but this guy was a candidate. I mean, I shouldn't be blanking. He played for Turkey and he was a candidate. He played in 2007, a candidate's match against Peter Lake. I remember this match because my coach at the time was Alexander Chernin, and he was... okay, I'm just going to look it up. I mean, I've played the guy, so...
But still, creating a culture, you know, in Turkish chess, I feel it's... I think they're getting there, and I feel it's a huge accomplishment for them, and it just goes to show that the amount of support and the amount of investment that they've done in the last few years has not been in vain. It's something that a lot of federations actually are starting to try to do. Yeah, Romanian Federation as well.
Yeah, and that's true. Romania has
the same type of results as well. But again, Turkey is one of those countries that right now is shining quite bright.
Yeah, I mean, Romania is investing a lot. So I found the player I was thinking of is Mihail Gurevich.
Gurevich, of course.
He's originally Ukrainian, but he was a top player, like a legitimately top player, you know.
Of course.
You know, probably top 10, maybe even higher than top 10. Yeah. And he played the candidates. I also mentioned that. But yeah, you know, Turkey is a country that hasn't had like really huge talents in a little while, you know. Like these guys like Yilmaz, he's my age. I mean, he's 1992. I played with him when we were kids, so he was a 26-50 or so player. But I mean, we're, you know, 30 something years old is not super young anymore.
So. And I feel he became about 26-50 into his late 20s or like mid 20s. Like he wasn't 26-50 when he was 18.
I think so too. Yeah.
He was sometimes already in his mid-20s. Like he was consolidating around the high 2500s, and then he made a push to the 2650s. But he was never considered to be one of those guys that could become a world champion. Right now, Erdoğmuş is probably very much in contention of having a future as a contender.
I mean, it seems very likely that he'll be a top player. You know, it's never... it's impossible to predict these things with 100% accuracy, but yeah, it would be surprising if he didn't become a top player, considering his age and his current level seems to be in the mid to high 2600 level. You know, it's kind of a shocking level for a player of that age, and it's hard to imagine what would stop him from becoming a top player. But it's still early. We still have to see.
And of course, good news for the U.S. is also that Abhimanyu is indeed, after consolidating around the 26-20 level, is indeed seeming to be making a push into the middle 2600s, 2650 or so. Right now, I think he's winning 23 rating points. So that will put him around close to 2635. So still,
yeah, I actually think that the U.S. has a pretty bright future.
It does.
I mean, if you think about it, like Misha is, yeah, as you mentioned, nearing the mid 2600 level at a young age. But we also have Woodward, who I don't know his exact rating now, but
he's about 2600. He's getting close to 2600.
It's probably approaching 2600 or at least in the high 25s. And he's, I think, younger than Misha. He's probably around 15 years old.
He's 15.
And we also have...
I mean, if I'm going to go with Brewington, he's been impressing me recently.
Yeah, Brewington, he won a tournament recently. It was the... I forget what the name of the tournament was. It was in the United Arab Emirates. And I think it was a very dominant score. Like 7.5 out of 9 or something. But I forget which city in the UAE. But it was one of these like really strong tournaments.
Or something
That was the name of it. Fujairah. I don't know how to pronounce it.
I'm probably mispronouncing it also.
But he won with a tremendous performance, like 27.50 plus performance, basically. So, and he's also very young. I think he's, you know, also around 15 years old, and in that like mid 2700, sorry, not 2700 yet, mid 2500s level, right. Yeah.
Yes.
But definitely or maybe early 2500s, but still, he's a young guy.
He's focused.
Yeah.
He's focused and determined. And I think that this generally breeds success, right? And he's also one of those guys in the US seems to be very much the case and very much the tradition that these very enterprising players, they decide to take a gap year from school. And I think Brewington is one of those guys as well. He quit high school. I don't think he's going to university. I think he's just focusing on chess right now.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I do know that...
that's what he told me at the US Juniors.
Okay. It's interesting. I mean, it's something that I did, of course, with my parents kind of backing. So maybe his family as well is looking in that direction.
And the Maurice Ashley Foundation, I think he's the first recipient of the scholarship.
Yeah, well, I can tell you a bit about that because I'm on the committee. Of course, it's pretty much entirely Maurice's initiative, and he put money into it and very generously donated his own money to help some of these young and talented players. And you know, I'm one of the people on the committee. Mm-hmm. And we were discussing, you know, Brewington as a player and as a talent. And also the fund gave money to two other players who are not as well known as Brewington, but still, you know, there are a lot of talents who can become good chess players, or potentially title players or grandmasters. Obviously Brewington is already there, but we also gave, I mean, not we, I, they were already selected. Some money to help the careers of Aiden Spellman and Ja'Cory Bynum. I think that was anyway. It's a really good initiative by Maurice. I think it's really cool.
Fabi, first masterclass. Thank you very much for doing this. I think this is going to be something that hasn't been done before in the world of chess and. Something that a lot of people, I hope, will be enjoying, you know, a masterclass from one of the best chess players in history. So thank you for your time and thank you for the masterclass.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, it was fun. We should... No, I think there's a lot of interesting games. We should keep it up. Have a look at some.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We'll try to do it every week. That's the plan for the moment. Thank you very much, guys, for watching, and we'll see you in the next one.